Before I start, I have to thank the organizers, not just for putting together a workshop, but also for being very flexible in scheduling. Because if you look at this chart here, you see there's exactly one person who causes problems, namely me. But I have an excuse. It's my secretary, who is a very motherly and protective person. And she feels I shouldn't come home too late, so she booked me on an early flight, which means I couldn't have spoken at the later slot. So thanks for rearranging things. It was also very encouraging to see a large number here of talks dealing with what I consider to be applications of cell automata, because in the lack of applications is always a bad sign for a field, because it tends to shrivel up and then become a little bit self-centered. So by that measure, obviously, we're doing very well. So having said that, I want to really take you into the dark heart of theory. Namely, I want to talk about classification. So this came about because Springer Verlag is putting together a huge encyclopedia of complexity and system science. Some of you are contributing to this effort, and so Andrew Adamowski asked me to write an article about classification of CA for this encyclopedia. And I foolishly agreed, and then as I started writing this thing, I became more and more frustrated because it's mostly bad news. We've already heard a talk just half an hour ago, so let me add more bad news. So when I say classification, what we ultimately would like to do is produce some kind of taxonomy. So this is sufficiently vague. It certainly describes the project. So what we're not interested in here at this point is sort of the coarse grain distinctions that one can obviously make by distinguishing, for example, between one or two-dimensional cell automata, finite grids versus infinite grids, certain types of configurations, or the grid topology even. This is all what I consider to be really the definitional level. So, this is just given to you. You don't have to worry about it. And once you have fixed these categories, then the real problems start. So at the very basic level, what you would like to understand, obviously, and these are really issues that come from sort of from dynamics, you would like to know whether the system is reversible. If it fails to be reversible, what's the degree of irreversibility? If you have infinite spaces where you actually have topology, you would like to know whether the map is open and so forth. Surge activity, and in general, what you would like to do is you would like to understand local structures in phase space. So what I mean by local structures is you only look at applications of the global map that is bounded by some fixed constant. So what you cannot talk about is orbits, right? So it's a small way of looking at things. And of course, that's not too particularly fascinating. What you really would like to do is understand the long-term behavior of the system. And the first sort of attempt to do this is due to Stephen Wolfram, who has produced these four classes. So you may notice what's on the slide here is different from what was on the slide 45 minutes ago. And there's a good reason for this, namely the Wolfram classes are inherently ill-defined, right? So I take certain liberties here and interpret them one way. This is following basically what Julie and you did. There is some vague idea of things becoming more and more complicated as you go through the classes from 1 to 4. But what exactly is going on there is not so clear. And so the only important point here is that in order to determine whether a cell automata is in one of these classes, local information is not enough. You have to know, you have to understand unboundedly many iterations of the global map. And as you'll see, this is actually really where the problem lies. Now, in Wolfram's defense, of course, if you look at the pictures, there's actually something compelling about the classification, right? I mean, 1, 2, 3, 4, done. And you can look at many of these pictures, and with a little bit of luck, you'll see 1, 2, 3, 4. And so, there is some general vague feeling that, in fact, this should be a reasonable way of classifying things. There are huge problems with it. I don't want to get involved, really. So what can you do? Well, at the very low end, when you just look at properties like reversibility or surjectivity, actually, things are okay, but they're okay in a very small way. So the first paper that seemed to sort of tackle this issue was Amoroso and Pat in 72, where they gave algorithms, combinatorial algorithms, to determine whether a one-dimensional cellular automaton is reversible or whether the global map is surjective. And I asked Sarah many times, what's the complexity of your algorithm? And he didn't care, really. So a little bit later, well, actually much later, 20 years later, I gave a very simple algorithm that's really just a rip-off of automata theory that solves those questions very, very efficiently in quadratic time. And it seems like this is the best you really can do. And at about the same time, Jarkko Kari showed that one-dimensionality really is crucial here, because as soon as you try to even ask the simple question, is a two-dimensional system reversible, it's undecidable in general. So it seems to be no coincidence that automata theory here actually comes into play. So that's okay. At least we can decide those two issues for the one-dimensional case. But if you try to somehow formalize Wolfram's classes so that you can actually really ask the question, is a cellular automaton in the class or no, then things become horrifically undecidable. And so even a very, very simple question such as, do all orbits end in fixed points, is undecidable. And it's not just undecidable, it's nastily undecidable. So, you know, if the fairy flies in and gives you as a present the halting problem, so you can now answer questions about the halting problem, you still can't do this. It's one level.
I mean, if it's undecidable, doesn't that imply all sigma and pi completeness?
No. This is a much stronger property. So undecidability is just a level, it's a level sigma 1. Yeah, no, this is much stronger. So this is another step up to the difference between decidable and the halting problem is essentially the same as between the halting problem and this stuff. It's another step up. And so things are very ugly there. And in particular, if you ask the question a lot of people are really interested in, namely, if I give you a specific CA, is the cellular automaton computationally universal? That's another two levels further undecidable. It's sigma 4 complete, so it's totally out of reach. And really, you know, you can write down the classes, but they are sufficiently highly uncomputable that they're not particularly helpful. And, you know, so these, of course, are, as always, abstract results, but they do cast a shadow. Because it is, in fact, really, really hard to prove that a cellular automaton is computationally universal. And, in fact, unless you've built this thing lovingly yourself, you probably can't do it, right? It's very, very difficult. Just look at Matthew Cook's proof of the universality of rule 110. It's a very nasty argument. I should also say, what's the problem? Of course, the problem is really purely computation theory, right? So you're dealing with the long-term behavior of the system, so what you have to study here is this relation configuration X goes to Y in an arbitrary number of steps, right? And that's undecidable in general. And it's, again, as nastily undecidable as it could possibly be. So if you look at the very closely related relation of confluence, so confluence means you're starting with two configurations, and you ask, are they going to wind up on the same limit cycle? Right, so this is very important because confluence is an equivalence relation, and it partitions your space into bases of attraction. So you would like to be able to say, you know, who goes to the same cycle. Well, they look to be very closely related, but in fact, you can cook up cellular automata where confluence is decidable and reachability is undecidable, and you can do it the other way around. You can make reachability decidable and confluence undecidable. So there is no easy way of getting any understanding of these diagrams. So it's getting more and more depressing, as you can see. What I should say is, unfortunately, the person I asked the question yesterday about measurability. So for topologists, these results are all totally irrelevant because the configuration spaces that you look at for these proofs are all sets of measure zero. It's irrelevant. It's nothing, right? It's a little bit of smudge along the edge because for the computability argument, typically you use configurations with finite support or you use very simple periodic configurations and they're all countable. They're dense in the whole space, but they're not closed. And somebody probably at some point should take a look at whether some other notion of computability gives better results. Type 2 Turing machines are currently very popular. What I hate about type 2 Turing machines is that in that setting, equality of arbitrary configurations becomes undecidable. And that's perverted, in my opinion. Right? I mean, if you cannot tell whether x is equal to y, what good is it? So anyways, this is just a side comment for this apologist. So are there any good news? Is there anything you can do? And so I already had a great introduction here to the decision problem, right, which really dates back to work by Hilbert. That's almost 100 years ago now. And what Hilbert really proposed is that we should try, in modern terminology, to go out and find an algorithm that decides all propositions of mathematics. And he made that very, very clear. I mean, obviously, he was thinking about it around 1900 already, but he made it very clear in this book that he wrote with his student Ackermann in 1928, where he really, you know, presented that problem. And 1928 was good, because if he had waited a little bit longer, Gödel would have shot him out of the water anyways, because Gödel showed in 31 that you can't do it, right? So there is, things are bad here. I mean, this is together with work by Turing. And so what has happened since, really, is that people have gone back and forth and tried to push the boundaries of... decidability and undecidability closer together, right? So you know that the whole thing is undecidable, right? And you know that certain things are decidable, so here's the good part and here's the bad part, and then you're trying to push the boundary a little bit closer by showing that some other theory is decidable, or maybe proving that something else is undecidable, and you build another knob and another knob, and hopefully you get closer and closer to this imaginary line in between. So for example, if you eliminate multiplication from arithmetic, it's decidable. If you throw in addition and multiplication, it's undecidable. Real numbers, on the other hand, are decidable. So there's been a lot of work, really done mostly by logicians, and no one else cared at all. In fact, it's kind of funny. So Tarski, who really started this, he was supremely uninterested in implementations. So he absolutely hated computers and didn't want anything to do with real implementations, despite the fact that, you know, he's the one who really proved sort of the one result that started the whole field. And so in the 1980s, the computer science community sort of got an idea that the Entscheidungsproblem actually might be of great use, and in fact of commercial use. And so the idea is, what you're trying to do in essence, you're fixing some suitable language, some suitable logic that allows you to make certain statements, and you should think of those statements as specifications. You're trying to say, for example, that a protocol never deadlocks, and you have to be able to write this down in a certain way. And you're looking at a bunch of structures. So structures is extremely weak. This could be just about anything. It could be hardware, software, it could be a protocol, whatever. And then the problem is, you would like to verify that whatever your structure you have at hand conforms to the given specification. That's really where the CS guys came in. And if you ask Intel, for example, after their fiasco with the floating point arithmetic, they're now very, very interested in being able to do this, because you can actually express the properties of the chip hardware in a certain way, and then you can use model checking to make sure that there are no bugs. Of course, they found out after the fact. So anyways, the CS angle is a little bit different from the classical math angle, because number one, there's an emphasis on algorithms. And when you say algorithms, you mean efficient algorithms, algorithms that you can actually run. Because, you know, obviously if you want to make sure that the next chip that Intel puts out really behaves properly, it doesn't help to have an algorithm that can do this in principle, but takes 2 to the n steps, right? It has to be reasonably fast. And there's another issue that the structures tend to vary quite a bit. And so the problem is, I'm giving you a structure and I'm giving you a specification, and you are supposed to come up with some nice algorithm that checks whether the structure conforms to the specification, where, you know, this from a certain class and that from a certain logic. And it's been a great success story, because people are able to actually handle systems that seem much, much too large. So you can routinely deal with structures here of size 10 to the 100. And you can actually test properties very, very, very efficiently. So can you apply this at all to cell automata? Well, why not, right? I mean, you can easily think of a cell automaton as a structure in this sense, where you have a configuration space and you have a next step relation. and that's all you have, right? So this is sort of the definitional part of the automaton. This will tell you what the dimension is and so forth. And here's just going in one step from configuration X to configuration Y. And now you want to be able to say things about the system. Well, let's say you keep it very, very simple. You sort of adopt the most pedestrian way to make assertions. For example, you would like to be able to say that phase space contains a substructure that looks like this. That's it. Not much more than that. So you have to be able to say that there exists a bunch of configurations, and this configuration, one step evolves to here, that one evolves to the same, then they both go to here, and so on and so forth. So what you need, well, you can get away with plain standard first-order logic. And here are just some examples of the kind of assertions that I want to consider, and here are the ones I don't want to consider. So the first one says, for all x, there exists a y goes to x. So that just means that the system is surjective, right? For every target x, there exists a predecessor y. And the next statement here is injectivity. If you have x evolves to z, and y also evolves to z, the same goal, the same target, then x must be equal to y, right? Injectivity. The next one says that everybody has at most two predecessors, and so on and so forth. But what you can't say is what you really need to do something like Wolfram's classes, for example, all x evolve to zero, to some default configuration, in any number of steps. That's too powerful. I'm only talking about taking single steps. And so now the question is there any hope that if I give you a solid automaton and I give you some formula here like injectivity, that you could actually check automatically whether it holds or not? That you can check automatically whether the property is obeyed by this? And when I say check, right, the emphasis is on automatic. You can't give it to your PhD student who comes back 2 years later and has some result, perhaps. So this has to be a simple algorithm. Well, I take back the simple, but there should be some algorithm to do this. So what do you need to do? Well, you've got to somehow... this is weird. You've got to somehow be able to make determinations about whether x goes to z in one step. You have to be able to check equality. You have to be able to deal with Boolean connectives. And you have to somehow deal with the quantifiers, right? So those are sort of the syntactic pieces of the expression that you're dealing with. And, well, how do you do this? Use automata. So just think about the essential problem. You're given two configurations, X and Y, and let's just talk about bi-infinite configurations. And you would like to know whether this configuration, X, in one step evolves to Y. Right? This is a property you have to be able to check. Well, so I'll just show you the picture of the automaton for one example, and you should be convinced this works in general. If you look at the local map, so this is the standard coordinate system here, right? Take the bit, take your own bit, and exclusive OR it with the bit to the right. I claim X and Y are okay, that is to say, Y is the image of X on the global map, if and only if you feed this to this automaton, it traces a bi-infinite path. So, you can just check if you have a bit in the top row and a bit in the bottom row, and the next thing you see is another zero and another one, a 0, 0, 0, 1, that's okay because 0 plus 0 is 0. It's just writing down the local map of the CA in a particular way. So the only thing to keep in mind is this automaton as input doesn't take single configurations, but sort of tuples of configurations. And you line them all up nicely, and then you read the bits in parallel for all the configurations. And so in a sense, with this automaton now, we can check whether X evolves to Y, right? Well, so what else do you need to do? Well, the first big surprise is, the pleasant surprise, is you can actually handle projections. You can handle existential quantifiers very easily, because all you need to do to check whether there exists some configuration X with some property is you erase the labels associated with the X track. You just keep the labels with the Y track, and then there is a configuration that has the right property, well, if and only if there was a path in the original automaton. So existential quantification comes for free. You just erase a few bits. And the Boolean part, you just use standard constructions from automata theory. Well, it's okay, that's a lie. So there's an easy part, the positive part, where you're dealing with OR and AND. That's not difficult. B, because OR, which, you know, logical OR just means you can write down the automata as a disjoint union, and you can actually handle a conjunction also directly by using a product machine construction. But negation is where, as always, things become ugly. Because in order to do negation, what you usually need is a deterministic machine, and turning the machines into deterministic ones is computationally expensive, right? So everybody knows if you look at automata on finite words, there's a blow up from n to 2 to the n. And since we're looking at infinite words, it's actually worse. It's something like 2 to the n log n. So complementation is very expensive, but it's perfectly algorithmic. You can do it. And so, I don't want to go into the details here, but the real problem is that you have to make the automata a little bit more complicated than the pictures that I've just shown you. And the way to see this is if you look at the simple question, instead of checking whether x is equal to y, which of course is easy, you want to check whether x is not equal to y. Well, if x is not equal to y, there must be one position where the bits differ, right? But since you don't know where this is, you have to sort of set up an automaton that infinitely far in the past is just looping around this state p, then waiting for the bad transition, and then infinitely far in the future it remains in the state q. So the acceptance condition gets a little bit more complicated. And in the classical literature, what's mostly considered is one-way infinite words. I mean, Büchi actually introduced these automata in the 60s to deal with that problem. But two-way infinite words are not that popular, and you have to monkey around a little bit, but you can adjust the definitions. All right, so in the end, you can build some automaton so that for any formula you can write down in the simple language, the cell automaton, the structure A rho, satisfies the formula. Well, the corresponding finite state machine can just compute all the corresponding configurations. So compute in the sense that will accept this input if and only if the formula holds. And so in the special case where the free variables, where there are no free variables, it's just a question of checking whether the acceptance language is empty or not. And now this is the crucial point, really. The basic properties of these automata are all decidable. You can check whether the acceptance language is empty, you can check whether it's universal, inclusion, all that. So it's all algorithmic. So you can actually test these things automatically. And so in the end, what you get is that model checking for the language, I have to be very careful here, right? The language is just plain first order logic with one step relation and equality. That actually is decidable. So this is sort of the good news. You can actually tell a few things, but be careful, this is really quite limited, because you cannot say anything about long-term behavior. You can only make statements about going one or two or three or four steps or some such. Right. And also, it's a little bit annoying, because in the process of unraveling this formula to build this automaton, every once in a while you have to do a determinization step, and that's hugely costly. Right. So it's very expensive. Though I actually went back and looked at the old construction for testing whether a one-dimensional cell automaton is surjective or injective. And you get essentially exactly the same answer, the same quadratic time algorithm out of this framework. So in some special cases, actually, you can get very, very reasonable algorithms out of this. But in general, it's going to be sort of a theoretical interest. So now the real challenge, which I don't really have time to go into this, the real challenge, I'll just show you the slide, is what can you do to push this a little bit? Is that all? So how could you make the result stronger? Well, one thing you could do is you could change the logic, right? But that's tricky, because you can't just add on reachability. If you add reachability, things become undecidable. You could consider special CAs. You could consider special configurations, like whatever, right? So this is very important. If you talk to an American undergraduate these days, you have to say like whatever often. Because otherwise, it's clear that you're an outsider, like. And so there are some good news and some challenges. The good news is you can actually, because automata are being used to do the decision process in the end, you can add unary predicates to the language that describe certain configurations. For example, you can talk in this framework about configurations with finite support. You can just add them on. It's not a problem. You can easily deal with non-deterministic cell automata because it doesn't really matter for these automata whether, you know, whether there's one follow-up configuration or many. The real challenge is, and this is, I'm not quite certain what the answer will be, is what happens if you, instead of looking at infinite configurations, you fix one particular rule, and now you look at all possible finite configurations, but finite in the sense that the number n of cells is variable. So I don't want an answer for n equal 5 or for n equal 100. I want to have an answer for all n. And what this really means is that in the end, I'll just show you the picture without the theory here, you're actually looking at beautiful functional digraphs like this, right? So this is, there were lots and lots of talks where you try to understand some aspect or other of the phase space of a cell automaton. So this is really the complete phase space, right? I fixed the number of bits probably to be 9. Actually, this is a quiz. What rule is this? Hint, it's an ECA. Burton. Without meaning to put anybody on the spot here. Right, it's 90, I think. Yeah. So this is a complete picture for whatever it is, 9 bits, n equal 9. And you'd like to understand the structure of this diagram, but not for n equal 9, for n arbitrary, right? In the sense of being able to answer questions. And so this is actually, I think, the next candidate one should look at, because as you can see, the structure for additive rules is extremely uniform. In a sense, really, if you understand one of these guys, and you know how many there are, well, okay, so there are two different types, right? There's this kind of basin of attraction and that. There are only two, and they're repeated a number of times. Once you know that, you can answer all questions. What's the other? So this is just the functional diagraph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they
break into
two classes.
Let's talk afterwards. So anyway, you know, so my challenge actually is then the following. Consider only, let's say, rule 90, whatever your favorite additive rule is, and find a way to decide all first order statements where you allow not just one step, which corresponds to taking a single edge here, but allow any number of steps. So in other words, beef up the logic, but reduce the cell automaton. I'll show you the picture here. So fix, okay, so I just said 90, now I say 150. It makes no difference. If you can do one, you can do the other for sure. Consider only finite grids, let's say, with cyclic boundary conditions, and find a way to decide all assertions in a logic that give you one step, any number of steps in equality. And I think it's doable, though it is not easy because you have to, you know, what you're dealing with really is a bunch of linear operators on finite spaces, and we know a lot about these operators. For example, we know what the minimal polynomials are, and we can do eigenspace decompositions, and we can actually compute the number of limit cycles and things like that. But it's not enough to do it for a single n. You have to do it uniformly for all n. And so, hi, Burton. So I don't know whether it's actually possible, but I would be really, really surprised if this turned out to be undecidable. I think it is. So, you know, this is just another step in this project of trying to push decidability a little bit further out and not falling into the trap of undecidability on the other side here. All right, in the interest of lunch, I think I should stop at this point.